The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Lots of titles centre around innovation. The tech sector claims to be one of the most creative and innovative, but our next guest is not convinced. He's travelled the world to find out more about the most innovative companies, and that's all in his book. David Rowan, author of Non-BS Innovation, joins me now. David, why did you decide to take on this subject?
I was running Wired magazine in the UK, which is a magazine about the future, about technology and science and design. And I kept getting asked to go and speak at corporate offsites to inspire the team because they wanted to show that they were innovative. And often these companies had crazy job titles. They had not just head of innovation, but an innovation sherpa, an innovation catalyst, a chief disruptive growth operator. And they'd often invested in startups and they had a corporate incubator. And I'd ask them, so what have you done to change the main company through all that you're learning with the corporate accelerator? And often the answer was, oh, well, it's too early to have any actual results, but we think we're on the way. And it reminded me of, you know, the Roadrunner cartoons where he chases Wile E. Coyote off the cliff and the coyote keeps running even though he's on air until he looks down and realizes he's not been on solid ground for a while and then he falls to earth. And I thought the problem with quarter by quarter responding to shareholders and analysts is you don't fundamentally change the mindset, the culture of a company, nor the business model when the internet is fundamentally changing everything from media to manufacturing. So we need to find a better way to change how we operate companies than say, we'll just tick the innovation box, because that's often just theatre.
And that's exactly it. You use this phrase, innovation theatre, where you're seeing a lot of companies, they're running these lovely workshops and events. They're not necessarily open to disruption. So what does true innovation look like? It's not in a separate building with these lovely accelerators and laboratories. What does true acceleration and innovation actually look like in dynamic companies?
So that's what I wanted to find out. I embarked on a 20-country journey from Peru to China, and I found a few common threads in the organizations that were actually doing amazingly impressive things to transform. One of the things I often found was the bosses realized that the real talent wasn't their department, it was the junior people, and they kind of wanted to empower the whole team. Another thing that seemed to be a common thread is they had diverse teams, cognitively diverse teams, who were thinking in different ways. And they were able in the culture of the company to challenge each other in a good-natured way. So if somebody came up with a new idea, it wasn't shot down. So I went to Google's moonshot factory called X, where they'll have a scientist next to a concert pianist, next to a former math teacher, and together, because they come with different approaches, they come up with a new way of doing things. A lot of what we talk about as an innovative company is actually a company that's dealing with the same pressures as everybody else, but they found a new way to think about it, to frame it in their mind. And there's a small bookshop in one of the most expensive streets in London, in Curzon Street in Mayfair, which is the most expensive square in the Monopoly board, that's been there since 1936. And I met Nicky Dunn, who took over about 6 years ago, and he had a problem. He couldn't compete with Amazon. He couldn't compete with the very expensive antiquarian booksellers. He was running a rented store in a very expensive part of town. And he thought, well, we're not going to win as experts in selling books. What about experts in curating collections of books? And they started offering a bespoke library service because they knew a lot of the people coming into the store were quite wealthy, quite well-educated. The first project, they were asked by a wealthy woman in Switzerland to put 3,000 books on modernist art in her mountain chalet. They charged more than €600,000. Now they're doing a monthly book subscription. They have half a dozen women who sit in the basement reading a couple of hundred books a year, and they'll customize their choices for you. They'll get to know you. Each month, you'll get a gift-wrapped book that they've chosen sent to you in the post. They're charging £400 or £500 for this. Suddenly, by reframing how they're thinking as experts in curating books, the business is doing financially very, very well. So One of the things that I also noticed is a lot of the companies that are doing really well and building future value and being able to walk away from a declining business to build the business that's going to be huge tomorrow, these are often businesses not owned by shareholders. And the biggest bank in Finland, called OPA, that's O-P, is owned by its customer members. It's a bit like a building society. And that gave them the power at the top, the board level, to say, OK, a lot of what banking is doing is being commodified by the internet. A lot of the money we make from lending money and foreign currency transfers, the startups are doing better. How do we go back to our core value promise to our customers? And it's more than 100 years old, this bank, OPA. And they've always been there to help their customers through difficult times, to borrow money to buy a house, to start a business, to borrow money to buy a car. Well, if these things are being commodified, why doesn't it do things that the startups can't do? What about helping keep their customer members healthy? So OPA has built 5 private hospitals in Finland. And because it started from scratch, it's built them really efficiently. You can have a scan that afternoon. If you need surgery, they'll do it the next morning. And because it's efficient and gets you back to work quickly, it's actually relatively cheap. So they have a health insurance product, which is competitive because it's cheaper, and it's now growing like anything. Then they thought, well, we're not going to make the money lending for people to buy cars in future, because in the future we won't buy cars, we'll use the autonomous electric cars on the network. Why don't we start something called mobility as a service, where you can use the app that the bank makes to rent a car by the minute? So it's thinking in a very bold way that challenges today's profit models but builds tomorrow's billion-euro business.
What about the bad examples? I've seen you on stage ridicule the Juiceros, the Quirkies. Tell us about them.
So I know quite a lot of smart venture capitalists who write very, very big checks, and even some of the smartest, don't tell them, make some silly decisions when it comes to looking for the next innovation. And there are a couple of painful examples over the last couple of years where lots of very respected investment funds have put more than $100 million into companies like Juiceroo, which was an innovation. It was making an internet-enabled juicing machine that had lots of sensors and Bluetooth. And the idea was, it was originally $700 to buy the unit, and then you had to buy these expensive sachets that it squeezed and made the perfect fresh juice. And that worked fine until some journalists at Bloomberg realized that you could squeeze the juice sachets in your hand without the $700 machine, and it was actually sometimes quicker and better than the original juicing machine. And of course, Juicero went bust. At the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is the big convention of, you know, new technology, every year they celebrate the new innovations. And sometimes you just have to treat it as satire. One of the products I saw last year was underpants that allegedly protect your personal areas from radiation. And this was celebrated as a great innovation at the show. And I'm thinking, it's funny, it's humour. It's not product innovation.
David Rowan, Wired UK founding editor and author of Non-BS Innovation, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.